skies so blue. The birds are singing, I got nothing to do. Hey, hey,
hey, hey.
Mm, it's a sunny day.
Sunny day now.
My pocket's empty, my cupboard's bare. But call me illogical, I just don't care. Hey, hey,
hey, hey, hey.
It's just a sunny day.
Hey, 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 it's a sunny day.
It's just
day.
A sunny day.
Ooh, yeah. Hey. It's the KSL Greenhouse. Expert tips for flowers, trees, gardens, and soil. Our hosts are Maria Chaleos and Ton Bettis on KSL News Radio.
Good morning and welcome to the KSL Greenhouse on this beautiful Saturday morning. It's not lost on me what a beautiful day it is. The day after it snows, the snow-capped mountains, Ton, and kind of the pink and blue hues as the sun comes up. What a beautiful capital city when the air's clear.
Yeah, I was looking at our traffic cameras when I was preparing for the show, and even though it was on the screens, I watched the sunrise over Foothill Boulevard and just those pink hues in the sky. It was a beautiful scene.
It is really a beautiful morning, and thanks for being with us for the KSL Greenhouse on a very chilly morning as well. And I think planning outside is not one of your top priorities today.
No, especially with the snow and the cold weather. Winter is actually finally here.
So. Right. It is finally here. And we know that Dave Meekham's jumping up and down rejoicing. And he's back with us this morning as well on the board. So, but we know that people still want to talk about planning. And we kind of, in January, kind of take pride in the fact that we start talking about things that people are interested in as far as getting ready for the next season and taking care of things right now that can still be taken care of. The plan of the morning is pothos. It's one of those, I want to call it a traditional house plant that when you think of a house plant, it's the one that you think of.
Yeah, it's been around forever and there are new varieties coming out all the time. And so the standard pothos just has a green leaf and it's a trailing plant. It is one that is very popular because it's very easy to grow. It tolerates lower life levels indoors. It doesn't like to be drowned, but if you let it dry out a little bit, it's usually resilient and bounces right back. And it tolerates our drier homes with our four central air heating. And so at any rate, the pothos is one that if you are just getting into houseplants, it's a good starter because it's one that's a little harder to kill.
Right. It's one of those that if you forget to water it 1 week, it does okay. It'll bounce back.
It doesn't tolerate overwatering for very long, but as long as you're not overwatering it and you have it in a room with light, you know, even offices with fluorescent lights, if you can get it up on top of a shelf or on top of a bookcase closer to the fluorescent lights with no windows, they actually will survive that if your lights are on or 8 or 10 hours a day.
And it's not one that really takes a lot of special care as far as nutrition.
No, the fact sheet that Michelle's posted for us talks about fertilizing it with half-strength houseplant fertilizer every other time you water it, so twice a month. I may do that a little more just to make sure that it is healthy, but it survives on very little.
Right. Anything else special? I want to hear about these new varieties that are coming out.
Well, the new varieties are usually just different variegated leaf forms.
Okay.
And so the standard pothos has a green leaf. And if you have them in very low light situations, they lose the variegation because they have to produce a lot more chlorophyll to capture whatever light energy they can. And so if you have them in brighter light off to the side of a window, then they will keep that variegation. And what you're usually seeing are new forms of either a creamy yellow or white variegation in the leaves.
Mm-hmm.
And when I say they're kind of splotchy, I don't want it to make it sound like that it's a bad form. It's not. And then the other thing that you will see with a pothos, you can buy them as just a houseplant and they're trailing and they can, you know, get several feet long, but you will also find them staked on a foam stake or a wooden stake growing up, and you can keep those going too. And so the newer varieties, there's usually one or two a year that you see, but they're just variations on the variegated leaf forms.
They're also very fast growing.
They are.
They're one of those plants. So maybe we should talk about how you maybe trim them back or keep them maybe under control.
Well, if you let them grow and grow and grow, the vines can get, you know, 20 or 30 feet long out of a pot. We had one in our office 10 or 15 years ago that had actually, we grew it down a hallway in the leaves were reaching about 30 feet in either direction. And the county said, well, we need your office space, so you're moving. And I had to cut it back. And I had one of our staff assistants in tears because she had spent years, you know, pinning those vines up and
making sure that they went in just the right spot.
Yeah. And so I had to guarantee that it would grow back. It didn't really. It's almost like I had somehow gotten rid of her puppy or something, and
I did,
but it had to be done. And so we got it cut back and it started to regrow and look nice. And so when you have these as a house plant, you need to, when you see a vine getting too long, nip it back 18 inches or so, and it will form a couple of new vines there. Because if you just let it go and go, it can get actually quite leggy at the where the pot is, and all the foliage is farther out. And if you do get it to that point and you just need a complete refresh, it's okay to go in and clip those vines 2 or 3 inches long above the soil in the pot. Maybe at that point, transplant it into a new pot. And within 6 weeks, it will start to form new leaves. You'll have a brand new plant.
So my question is there a particular place on the vine that you need to nip it?
Well, you can root them very easily. And so what I would recommend doing is just along the vine with the newer growth, just get a section of it that's 3 or 4 inches long so that you have a series of 3 to 4 leaves. And then you're going to leave the top leaf intact and carefully snip the 2 or 3 leaves underneath off, and then put that into either perlite or vermiculite or even water. Mm-hmm. And it will form new roots, and then you, after about 8 weeks, can replant that into new potting soil, and it will grow.
Okay, but if you are trimming it back, is there a reason to cut it in a specific place on the vine?
Oh, if you cut it at a leaf node, so right in, as you're following it out, you want to stop at a leaf on the vine, and where the leaf is how long you want it. You just clip it right at that leaf. If you clip it an inch or two longer and there are no leaves, that stem will eventually die until it has the leaf there.
Oh, okay.
And it will, if you clip it, it will form some side vines and continue to grow. But short of just having an unsightly little section of stem, it's not too important.
Yeah, but it's interesting that if you do kind of cut it back, it will grow more foliage right where the plant is planted.
It will.
Okay. All right. Anything else about pothos we need to know?
Just if you've never grown houseplants or had bad luck, as long as you don't have this in like a really dark room, put it off to the side of an east or a west or even south window, turn it once in a while, clip it back once in a while, and just water, fertilize it. It will be one of the easiest houseplants you can grow.
All right. Number to call with your questions, 801-575-8255. Phone lines are open at this hour. Also, you can find out more about the pothos houseplant, the plant of the morning, on the KSL Greenhouse Facebook page. I'll wake up here any second now. My brain will start functioning. And you can also text us your questions at 57500. Good morning, and thank you for joining us for the KSL Greenhouse. Maria and Ton with you this morning. Phone lines are open if you'd like to get your call in early at 801-575-8255. You can also text us at 57500.
Yesterday, I got a text from one of the owners of All Red Orchards down in Payson. And I will say it's probably the largest female-owned farm in Utah. put that out there. Oh, okay. All Red Orchards is managed by two sisters.
Debbie, I didn't know that. Yeah. Okay, awesome.
Anyway, one of them had a question. Their son is moving into a new home with raised beds, and she was wondering what kind of soil to put into the raised beds. What are the options? And it can be very confusing because retailers, you know, the nurseries will usually have a raised bed mix. The larger ones have one in bulk. There are bagged raised bed mixes you can use that are all really good products. Mm-hmm. And, but they can be expensive. You know, I know that I've been to retailers where raised bed mix in bulk can cost anywhere from $70 to maybe $100 a cubic yard. And that cubic yard will do a 5x10 bed about 6 inches deep, okay, just for an approximation. And the raised bed mixes will break down over 2 or 3 years because they're mostly peat moss and bark and things like that. And so you need to refresh them either with an inch or so of material every fall or a new 3 or 4 inches every 3 or 4 years. So that can be, it's almost like you're paying not just for the seeds and plants to garden, but you're paying another $100 or $200 a year just for the privilege of having your potting mix.
Right.
So there is that option, and that is very easy. It's light. It's easier to move. Another option, if you can find it, would be a raised bed mix, or excuse me, a sandy loam or a sandy soil. And you can pick up sandy soil from some of the gravel pits. You know, the Sandy City area may have something. The Layton Bench has some gravel pits up in the Cache Valley, the Preston area.
We don't usually see this as a good thing.
No, but my train of thought here is that you mix that sandy soil 1 to 1 by volume. So for every cubic foot of soil, you have 1 cubic foot of compost, mm-hmm, and you mix them thoroughly into your raised bed. And then you apply triple 16 over the top at just the recommended rates. You can use like a tomato rate or something to make sure that you have enough phosphorus and potassium, because our sandy soils are notorious for being deficient in phosphorus and potassium. Mm-hmm. Then what you would do is just get compost once a year, about 1 inch to 2 inches, and you mix that in the fall after you're done gardening, which this compost is going to be far less expensive than raised bed mix. You mix it in the fall so it breaks down over the winter a little bit, and it's ready to do its thing in the spring. But some of the best raised beds I have ever seen have actually used this combination of sandy soil and compost to grow plants, because the drainage in there will grow just about anything, because sandy soil usually has a slightly lower pH because it's less reactive, just for the nature of the sands. It's a lot of chemistry we don't need to get into. So you have a slightly lower pH, and then all the compost in there drops it a little more. You don't have an acidic soil, but the soil retains more nutrients, and with that drainage in there, things root really well.
So is that equal to the raised bed mix if you go through all of those steps?
You know, I think it is. The sandy soil can be a little harder to find. You can find it, and you may have to drive a little farther. The raised bed mix has the advantage of being light and just easier to handle in a wheelbarrow, but you have to do the handling more often. You have to handle it more often because it breaks down. Once you get the sandy soil mixed with the compost, then the maintenance equals out a little bit, and the compost, you can usually find a good compost like Soil Pep, Soil Prep. The Nutrimulch is another one. Oakdale has some really good composts, but those are usually less expensive than raised bed mix moving forward. And it's the same maintenance, to where you put down 1 inch or 2 and mix it into that sandy soil.
Okay, so it's all about your space I mean, if you have a huge space, you're going to go with the sandy soil mixture.
If you can find it, yes. Just because longer term, it will be less expensive. We had a community garden when I was working out of the Cache Valley in Nibley that we used this one-to-one mix of sandy soil with compost, and it was phenomenal what people were growing in it. And we had it about a foot deep, and it did really well.
Right. I have been watching a new documentary on Netflix, You Are What You Eat, and I think we're going to gain a lot of listeners if people watch that documentary. It's all about, you know, eating more greens.
Yes.
And so I think in the coming weeks, we should talk a lot more about things that you can plant, and maybe our problem is our season isn't long enough to sustain you throughout the year.
No, we talk about this, and I know we're getting close to a break, and I've watched some of these documentaries of people living off the land in South Georgia and Florida and Hawaii, and then we're here in
Utah.
You're like,
Utah. Oh, we're not going to be able to do that year-round.
And even in Las Vegas and St. George, you can grow some food year-round, but not here.
But even saying that, you can grow your food for a nice long season here, but it's hard to store lettuce.
It is hard to store lettuce. You can grow lettuce for 9 or 10 months fairly easily out of the year if you really want to for 12 months. But, you know, you can grow food quite a long time.
Right. And we've talked a lot in the past about low tunnels and ways to extend your season. And if you haven't heard those conversations, we'll have them again for sure. But we do have videos that we have done that you can find on the Facebook page and that you can also find on the KSL Greenhouse YouTube channel if you'd like to go back and just see some ways that you can start your season far earlier than you had thought if you put in some of these low tunnels.
Yeah, they're fantastic devices. They'll last for quite a while. And so you can have them for years. You might swap out the plastic every 2 or 3 years, but they are something that if you enjoy gardening, they'll extend your season by about a month to 6 weeks on either side of the gardening season.
All right. We're going to take a break. Come back with your calls and questions. You can call us right now at 801-575-8255, or you can text us your questions at 57500.
The Greenhouse Show on KSL News Radio.
Good morning. Welcome back to the KSL Greenhouse. Maria Chaleos, Ton Bettis with you this morning. We are taking your calls, and the phone lines are open at 801-575-8255. You can also text us your questions at 57500. First texter of the morning, Ton, would like to know what they can use to get rid of peel to roly-poly bugs in their carrots in the garden. Now, help me out. There's, I'm sure, some autocorrect issues here.
Yeah, it's roly-polies are just those little, we call them potato bugs or the sow bugs.
So I do know what they are. Bugs. Okay, roly-poly bugs.
Yes. And the key to this is moisture. They are very common where there is high humidity and available soil moisture. And so the trick to minimizing their numbers is to maybe switch over to drip irrigation to where you're using like inline drip with an emitter every 4 or 6 inches and then growing your carrots and other things accordingly. It's probably not the answer they want. They could try also some diatomaceous earth or compost. They seem to not like coarser compost, so something like soil pep or even a little bit more coarse than that could help around the plants. And then if they're really bad, they can go out in the mornings and use some of the same tricks that you would use for earwigs and put out a folded newspaper, you know, a section of newspaper or some cardboard that is folded in half so that they go in between. And then you would empty those into a bucket of soapy water, just with an inch or two of water in the bottom with some soap in it. And you can reduce the population that way also.
Are they harmful?
Not generally. They are decomposers. And so that's why they're in the moist, you know, the wetter areas where there's lots of organic matter. And when they start feeding on carrots and feeding on other plants and things, they can be a secondary pest, and especially if there is a lot of moisture.
I just think of them as not being harmful. I mean, as a kid, you know, you're out in the garden just putting them in your hand and watching them curl up.
Yes, and that's their defense, and, you know, against being eaten or, you know, we kind of, our kids like to play with them.
Children,
no, it's not a good defense against children. But I think every kid at one point or another has had pet roly-polies that mom and dad have had to release back into the garden when the kids aren't paying attention.
Yeah, I just but, never thought of them as being
yeah,
harmful.
They're there because there's available organic matter that needs to be broken down.
Okay, we have a listener who is listening in Texas this morning.
Nice.
And their question is... they're in a new development and the soil looks like clay, so they want to know how to deal with that so they can plant flowers and bushes.
So the text is, I was still enamored that we have a Texas listener. They
yeah,
have a clay soil
awesome.
And they want to plant flowers.
Yeah, they just want to know how to deal with the clay soil. They want flowers and bushes and things.
Lots of compost. In Texas, it will break down more quickly because of the warmer temperatures year-round and... depending on where they're at in Texas, West Texas is fairly dry, but still warmer. If they're in East Texas and where they have the subtropical humid climate, they would break down more quickly. But I would incorporate 2 to 3 inches of compost annually into that clay until they're happy with what they have and continue with 2 inches annually because it will break down more quickly.
It's the beauty of the internet, you know.
Yes.
People can listen wherever they want to.
Yes, and a lot of times it's people that, well, they've had to have lived in Utah at some point, but it's been fun. I think the farthest away we've had contact is Brazil.
That's pretty far.
Yeah, and it's somebody in the military, but
interesting.
Yes.
Okay, so next texter says, since we had a late start to our winter, when's it going to be safe to trim our trees and bushes?
That is a topic I wanted to get to. And so pruning, I was seeing on social media lots of questions. December's been so warm. Can I just prune now? And the answer is absolutely not. The reason being is that every time you make a pruning cut, the plant wants to not really heal the area because that's not the term, but they want to seal it off and compartmentalize where that pruning cut was made. They actually form a layer of cells that will prevent moisture from losing moisture from the wound. And those cells will develop a lot of defensive chemicals that will be the tree or bush's attempt to ward off diseases and insect pests from entering through that wound. It's not always effective, but the trees will do that. And so when you prune, when even in the fall after the leaves have dropped, those trees and shrubs are not dormant yet. They still, especially if the ground isn't frozen or shooting new root growth, searching for nutrients for the next year, they are moving nutrients from the stems down into the roots. And they're not completely dormant until January. And so when you start pruning in November and December, and the tree then has to go in and compartmentalize every pruning wound you've made, it delays dormancy for sometimes 6 weeks to 2 months. And it reduces cold hardiness in the entire plant if you made lots of pruning cuts, so that you lose 20 to 30 degrees of cold hardiness at least.
Oh.
And so it's especially damaging with cherries and peaches, even apricots, nectarines. Those are absolutely, just do not prune those in fall, with the only exception being dead wood or diseased wood. Then when you can start pruning is sometime in mid-January, when we've had temperatures like we're getting, thanks to Dave. This is his fault. And so when we have temperatures that are in the 30s every day, high 20s, in the teens at night, through January into mid to late January, once those trees are fully dormant with those colder temperatures, you can start pruning on your shade trees if you need to. you still need to watch because the temperatures need to be above 10 degrees at night for 10 days to 2 weeks, because even then, when you make those pruning cuts, those will take 2 or 3 weeks for those pruning cuts to start to harden off and become cold hardy again. And they won't tolerate temperatures below about 10 degrees, especially on fruit. And so that's when we can start. The orchards traditionally start pruning after Christmas in January because of this, because the trees are finally dormant, and they start with tart cherries and apples and pears because they tolerate the pruning a lot better than the stone fruits. And once those are done, they move into stone fruits. And so for shade trees, mid to late January, fruit trees, apples and pears, mid-February, stone fruits, mid-March. Now, if you have, you know, we get calls from people saying, well, I'm going on a mission or my work's going to get busy, I need to prune. And so if you have to prune, mid to late January is when you start, and you watch that weather to make sure to the best of your ability for about 10 days you have temperatures above 10 at night after you prune, so that those trees can readjust the best they can to regain their cold hardiness.
All right. Glenn is on the line in Orem. Good morning, Glenn. What was your question?
I have a question as to how to prune Carl Forrester grass and Royal Candles Veronica.
So Carl Forrester, you can cut it down in the fall after it's turned brown. People sometimes leave it because it looks ornamental. The challenge with that is that if we get heavy snow, it can split out and be more difficult to cut back in the spring. But the option is yours on that one. Now, on your Veronica, is it a ground cover or an upright perennial?
It's upright.
So as soon as it freezes in the fall, you can cut it within a couple inches of the ground.
Oh, that far down.
Yep. That far down, because it's going to regenerate from the roots and some crowns near the soil surface and not the stems. And so if it's completely brown, just cut it back.
And so back to the Carl Forrester, how far down, how close to the ground do I cut that?
6 inches to a foot, depending on the height, where you can just reasonably go in and cut. What I used to do is get a set of hedge trimmers and carefully have someone hold that grass, or you can get some rope and tie it in a bundle, almost like you're doing the old-fashioned wheat. If you're out hand cutting and doing things like that, tie it off with some twine or a rope, and then just get some hedge trimmers and cut it so that it stays in a bundle and it's easier to handle.
And so I want to cut what looks like dead, the brown stuff, and not the green.
The green stuff can be cut back too.
Oh. Okay. Is it too late to do it now?
No, you're fine.
Okay. I had to dial this 8255 number 4 times. I got all kinds of messages that didn't accept my call. I don't know what's going on.
Hi.
Interesting. We'll check that
out.
Anyway,
I've enjoyed your program for 100 years. I've recommended it to a lot of people.
Well, thank you.
You're really great, all of you.
Glenn, we appreciate your call. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
And we'll check out that phone problem. And the number to call on the phone lines are open is 801-575-8255. We're getting in a bunch of texts. We'll get to your text questions up next. You can text us 57500. Good morning. Thank you for spending your Saturday morning with the KSL Greenhouse. Maria Anton with you, taking your calls, and the phone lines are working. 801-575-8255. You can text us at 57500. Next texters, Ton wants to know, they want to know if a houseplant can come back after freezing in their car overnight. They're not sure of the name of it, but it has small green leaves with white or pink polka dots.
It could be one of a few different things. What I would do is, if the soil did not freeze, then the roots are alive. I just bring it inside, cut back the damaged foliage, keep it watered as normal. Don't overwater it. Maybe just some light houseplant fertilizer and put it in a bright window and give it a month and see if it regenerates growth.
So the roots aren't dead, so give it a shot.
Yeah, if
but
the
it's
roots
not
froze,
look very
it's
pretty.
Done.
Yeah. Next listener says they have a 2-year-old Pacific Sunset maple that still has most of its leaves. Should they do anything to help it?
No. Hopefully, dropping leaves is a physiological process that doesn't happen on damaged foliage or damaged branches. Mm-hmm. So I'm hoping the tree's okay. They can go in and hand strip them, and it won't hurt the tree as long as they don't rip the bark. But they don't need, the only thing that I could think is if there's so many on there, we get a wet, heavy snow and it will bend the branches and maybe snap them. Maybe they do remove them, but otherwise it's okay.
Yeah, I have an ornamental one in the backyard and I noticed that I forgot to go out and I was going to go strip the leaves because it's such a fragile plant and I didn't. So I went and shook the snow off to make sure that's not going to break my branches.
That will happen. And that is one thing you can do. There's been many days growing
gently.
Up that I was out there with a broom handle, just gently moving the branches around to knock the snow off.
Next listener asks, is it time to start onion seeds?
Yeah, you can start onion seeds in the next couple of weeks. It doesn't need to be right now, but January is the time to start onion seeds.
Next listener would like to know, they've heard January is the time to prune their flowering pear tree, and they want to know if that's right.
Wait for February. There's no rush.
Okay. Next person has been trying to get rid of a trashy tree. They're not sure what kind of a tree it is. They've cut it down. They've tried to poison it. 2 months ago, they cut it down again, and they want to know what's an effective way to poison or kill it.
They need to use a concentrated weed killer. So concentrated glyphosate, concentrated lawn weed killer, and they need to go into the trunk 6 or 8 inches below where they made the initial cut and drill into the trunk on a 45 degree angle with a paddle bit or something, a wood boring bit.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, you want at least a half inch, maybe even a little wider, drill in about an inch, inch and a half every couple of inches around the trunk. And Phil, as you're drilling, have someone go behind you with that weed killer in the concentrate and fill every hole you've drilled. And that will hopefully absorb into the conductive tissue and work its way through the root system. And it's fairly effective. I have noticed with Siberian elms, it can be kind of effective, but it's the best thing we have.
Mm-hmm.
But absolutely stay away from tordon if it's in your yard. Tordon can get into the root system and stay for up to 2 years and damage a lot of ornamental plants that you want to keep. And it's against the law to use it in residential areas.
In your opinion, is it best to call in a company to maybe grind out the stump of the tree?
Not until it's dead.
Okay, that's not going to make a bit of difference.
You'll just make it angry, and every root that's left over will sprout new mini trees, and it will express its anger in less than healthy ways.
Okay, I don't need that. Next listener wants to know, what's your opinion on tilling versus no tilling?
Oh, I'm somewhere in the middle. I know people, especially growing up, that engaged in what we kind of sarcastically call recreational tilling,
mm-hmm.
to where you've had a bad day and instead of yelling at the wife and yelling at the dog and breaking things, you go out and till in the garden. And what will happen is you can ruin your soil structure if you have a loam or a clay soil. And so in those soils, to have a healthy soil, what will happen is that organic matter, as it breaks down, will have soil particles glued to it. And
mm-hmm.
it forms what are called aggregates. And these soil aggregates will be more likely to hold on to soil nutrients, but it creates air drainage in the soil, and it creates spaces for roots to penetrate into a lot more easily. And every time you till, you destroy some of the soil aggregates, which you absolutely don't want to do. And so the no-till theory is that you are incorporating organic matter very carefully using a spade or a shovel, you know, turning the soil and letting these aggregates form and stay. And Mike Caron, who's on the show fairly frequently, uses a no-till gardening method and has fairly good success. But the disadvantage is that you can get a buildup of certain weeds. And if you have a filled bindweed problem, no-till can make it a lot worse, because cultivating bindweed strategically can help control it, or at least reduce its population. And so there is that too. You also can get buildup of certain pests where, you know, squash bugs, grasshoppers, you're going to have higher populations because turning the soil will help that out. So we might need to continue this, because it's a lot deeper conversation than saying I'm all about no-till or I love tilling.
Okay, we'll have to have a deeper conversation on that. We need to take a break for the top of the hour news. Thanks for joining us. Number to call with your questions, 801-575-8255. We're going to talk about seed catalogs when we come back, so stay with us on the KSL Greenhouse Show.